Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to review most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today, and then some brief excerpts from a talk. The first guest is Greg Shupak, author of an article in Jacobin magazine on the dire complications of NATO's intervention in Libya, timely as the U.S. contemplates another humanitarian bombing campaign, allegedly to rescue Syria. Then Monica Potts, a staff writer at the American Prospect, talks about the healthcare crisis among poorer white women. And finally, some brief excerpts from a talk given in the Bronx a couple of weeks ago by the literary critic Gayatri Chakraborty Spivak on the relevance of Antonio Gramsci today. First up is Greg Shupak, a writer and activist up north of the 49th who teaches media studies at the University of Guelph in Ontario. He's got a piece on the Jacobin magazine website on the bad effects of NATO's bombing campaign in Libya, which could be a foretaste of what might happen in Syria should the Tomahawk start flying soon. Greg Shupak. As we ramp up for yet another humanitarian intervention, this time in Syria, you've just written a review of how things turned out at one of those that a lot of people, not all of them reactionary warmongers, cheered on, the NATO bombing of Libya. What were the results of that intervention?
Well, the Libyan intervention, in short, prolonged the conflict, created and led directly to war crimes, human rights violations, and left Libya in a state of chaos, and that's sort of where it seemingly still sits today.
I've just been reading some of Amnesty International's material on Libya, and they recount a riot of revenge, beatings, killings, jailings. It doesn't seem like life has improved dramatically in Libya with Gaddafi gone.
No, I don't think that it has, and I think what's particularly notable about the violence that has ensued since NATO began its bombing campaign is the racialized nature of much of the violence. Black Libyans have been targeted, as well as migrant workers from other countries further south in Africa. These groups have been subject to some particularly gruesome incidents during the NATO bombardment and afterwards.
There's a similarity between Libya and Syria. Once again, we're called upon to support a bunch of rebels as the enemy of a tyranny, but we don't know much about who they are, who supports them, and what they would like to do if they gain power. Tell us something about the Libyan rebels. What do we know about them?
Well, I think as the intervention was going on, the short answer would be that not terribly much was known about them. Certainly there was some evidence to suggest, as well as rumors to suggest, that there were al-Qaeda elements among the Libyan rebels. I don't think it's fair to necessarily say that characterizes the entire lot of those who sort of went to the streets initially to protest against the Gaddafi regime. But certainly there was a strong Islamist bent to the uprising against Gaddafi, or at the very least to the fighters who NATO supported and who NATO provided air cover for. So I think that's a salient characteristic, the religious conservative bent of the fighters. And in the aftermath of Gaddafi's overthrow, you saw, you know, efforts to implement Sharia law and some anti-homosexual laws being implemented, as well as laws against the denigration of Islam, as well as laws outlawing criticism of the regime itself.
Let's talk about the bombing runs. As we're now hearing with Syria, the NATO attacks were sold as being exercises in precision, with a minimum of civilian casualties. What was the reality of the Libyan bombing campaign?
Yeah, well, the reality of the bombing in Libya is that if the bombing campaigns were precise, then that means NATO has quite a lot to answer for. So they can either say, we carried out a precision bombing campaign and deliberately killed a lot of civilians, or they can say, we carried out an erratic bombing campaign, and this is part of the inherent nature of bombing campaigns, particularly in urban areas, and as a result, we killed lots of people. But the short answer is that the NATO bombing campaign destroyed Libyan infrastructure and killed a great many civilians. Sirte, for example, one of the major cities in Libya, one of the areas in which Gaddafi maintained a lot of support until the end, was particularly devastated by the bombing campaigns. And in Maximilian Forte's Slouching Towards Sirte, which I think is a very valuable guide to NATO's intervention in Libya, Forte details a lot of the accounts that journalists, primarily Western journalists, had relayed upon visiting Sirte after the NATO bombing had commenced. And so you can get sort of an endless list of analogies in these descriptions between European cities post-World War I, European cities post-World War II. So see, one journalist compares it to Leningrad, or you see other comparisons to Gaza after various Israeli bombardments, but most particularly cast lead in 2008-2009. So in other words, the picture that's painted is of a city in ruin, a major city. Now, in addition to the widespread devastation of Sirte, and there has been no, I should say, detailed investigation into the particularities of how many civilians exactly were killed in Sirte, but it is worth pointing out that there were other incidents in other places as well. So, for example, a farming compound in the city of Meher was bombed on, or the village of Meher, I should say, it was bombed on August 8, 2011, by NATO. And at least 34 civilians were killed in this raid. The tactic that NATO used here would be familiar to people who follow the drone strike campaign. It was the double tap tactic, which is to say that the compound was struck with NATO bombardment, and then moments later, after, you know, bystanders went to try and aid the wounded and tend to the dead, further bombardment hit the site in a tactic that seemingly has no purpose other than to kill first responders or Good Samaritans. And this was all documented in the UN Human Rights Council's investigation, which it did in early 2012 into NATO's campaign in Libya. And they described this farming compound as being, they described NATO's description of the bombing campaign as NATO called it a command and control center. And the UN investigation, the UNHRC investigation, found this description to be false. It was not a farming compound with any military purpose. And they therefore conclude that this was a war crime, which NATO carried out. Similarly, Reggie Sirani, the world-renowned, highly respected Palestinian human rights lawyer, was a member of the Independent Civil Society mission to Libya, and his look at NATO's bombing campaign led him to conclude that there was reason to think that there were some war crimes perpetrated by NATO as well. So what you have in Libya was this rather absurd situation where NATO intervenes on the pretext of wanting to put a stop to the war crimes that were certainly being committed by Gaddafi's forces and also by the rebels. And in this process, NATO carries out war crimes of its own. So it commits war crimes in the name of stopping war crimes.
Okay, now it's time to bring up the standard critique of this sort of analysis. Don't you care about the suffering of Libyan or Syrian people? Because Gaddafi was a terrible despot, as is Assad, and we must reach out through high explosives to save them. What's your response when you hear this sort of thing?
Well, my response is that I agree with the assessment generally of Assad and Gaddafi that you've offered. However, I mean, there's the situation is considerably more complex than the way it's described by the argument you're relaying here. So I would point out, first of all, that the mere fact that a given rebel group opposes a tyrant does not in any way demonstrate the commitment to human rights of that rebel group. Okay, so we have to make that distinction, first of all, that just because you're opposing a dictator doesn't mean that you necessarily have a commitment to ushering in something demonstrably superior. But I do want to stress that I think those are matters for the local population in places like Libya and Syria to sort out, primarily, much more so than it is an issue for Western leftists or liberals to determine. But the second point I wanted to make here is that, and I think this is the really crucial point, what people in the West or elsewhere around the world who are sympathetic to the miserable suffering of the Syrian civil war and sympathetic to the desire of peoples to emancipate themselves from dictatorships, I think you have to look at what the available options actually are. And so in Libya, at the time of the Western intervention, you had a stalemate between the rebels and Gaddafi, or in fact, a situation where it looked likely that Gaddafi was perhaps going to be able to defeat the rebels. In Syria, you of course also have a stalemate, a military stalemate. So what I'm getting at is that I think the main thing that people who are concerned about the suffering population in somewhere, in a place like Libya or Syria, is to look at what the available options are and ask, are there alternatives that are going to produce a peaceful settlement in short order, or at the very least a ceasefire? In Libya, there were many options on the table as far as diplomatic solutions. So any number of these could have helped facilitate whatever outcome the various parties in Libya agreed to, and could have helped facilitate a democratic or at least peaceful transition. So
I'm speaking with Greg Shupak, who's author of a piece in Jacobin magazine about the consequences of the Libya intervention.
Specifically, to be more specific rather than just generalizing about nice-sounding peaceful diplomatic solutions, I can tell you that from the time of the UN Resolution 1973, which authorized, quote, all necessary measures to protect civilians in Libya, Gaddafi's government put forth five ceasefire offers or offers of negotiation. So these were all rejected out of hand by NATO. So I think one thing that people in NATO countries who are legitimately concerned with reducing suffering of people in Libya could have done and ought to have done, and certainly some did, is push for our governments to engage seriously and constructively in those sorts of peace talks. The International Crisis Group put forth an offer for a transition of power from Gaddafi, done diplomatically, and this was not listened to either. Hugh Roberts of that International Crisis Group wrote a lengthy article on that for the London Review of Books, which I think is available online and is worth looking at. Again, I think some of those lessons apply to Syria. So that was, the International Crisis Group presented another option there. And another notable instance is the African Union also had put forth peace proposals and offered to facilitate diplomacy. Surely an African solution to the conflict in Libya is much more legitimate and preferable to Western intervention, given the history and present of Western colonialism and neocolonialism in Africa. So this was another peace proposal that could have been pursued, that people who care about peace and human rights in the West, sorry, people in the West who care about peace and human rights in Libya might have helped push for. And then notably, Denis Kucinich, the congressman, the American congressman, he basically helped broker a derivative of that African Union plan that, in his description, he wrote an article about this in The Guardian in 2011. In Kucinich's description, this peace deal that he was helping broker was on the verge of being realized. I think this was in June, so a few months into the intervention. But according to Kucinich, NATO officials scuttled that peace deal. So, again, I think the Kucinich deal was another opportunity for a diplomatic, peaceful solution to be reached in Libya. And there's been writings from people like Patrick Coburn in The Independent on Syria in the last week, and his assessment of how diplomatic options can be still realized at this stage, or at the very least a ceasefire in Syria, and this surely is preferable to any sort of sustained or even minimal or whatever that term that Obama used was, I think, limited and precise bombing campaign. And I read, in fact, last night I was talking about the International Crisis Group with regard to Libya. Well, they put out a statement yesterday, September 1st, which I read, and they have some, constructive ideas for outlining a potential ceasefire or at least a rejuvenating of diplomatic discussions.
Finally, I hope the audience forgives my skepticism, but when the U.S. government waxes humanitarian, given its long history of imperial violence, I get very suspicious. There are undoubtedly strategic goals behind the pretty rhetoric in the case of Libya. What were those? What was really motivating the U.S. in its push for intervention?
Yes, quite a few strategic goals were in play there, as they are in Syria. So a major one, if not the principal one, would have to be AFRICOM, which is the United States Africa Command. And that is a military base that is located in Germany. It's an American military base that has relationships with 53 African countries. So AFRICOM is something that the United States has been using to try to leverage its relations with as many African countries as possible, frankly. And before the intervention in Libya, there was Libyan opposition to setting up a base for AFRICOM in Libya. There are cables that Forte cites in his book where you have American ambassadors referring to Libya as being a substantial barrier to setting up AFRICOM on the African continent. And notably, after Gaddafi was gone, the NTC, which is the National Transitional Council, i.e. the rebel group that sort of led the overthrow of Gaddafi, they accepted AFRICOM, or rather they took a very different stance from Gaddafi. They were welcome and warm to the idea. Welcoming the idea and were warm to it, I should say. So AFRICOM is one important context, I think. The desire of the United States to set up more and more military relationships in Africa. So why would they want these military relationships? Well, there are several reasons for that that I think speak to the initial question you asked about why would or what would drive NATO, because we know NATO, frankly, is not some sort of global police force for human rights. So related to AFRICOM is the interest that the United States has in African resources. And these include not only oil, of course, which, Western Africa has a fair bit of, as does Libya. Well, Western Africa has quite a lot. But also strategic minerals, minerals that are important to military development in the United States. So I'm thinking of things like columbium, chromium, cobalt. Okay, these are all central for weapons manufacturing. And these are located in places like Mozambique, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Congo. For the United States to have access to these is central to sort of the whole imperial project, because their weaponry is needed to maintain and enforce and expand that imperial project. Now, the sort of third point about the interest in having greater access to Africa and its resources is that the Chinese have become major, major trading partners with a whole host of African countries. So, you know, just to give you an example, China, if you treat Africa as, if you treat all the African countries as one sort of economic unit, if you treat the entire continent that way, you'll see that China in 2009 surpassed the United States as Africa's largest trading partner. China gets a third of its imports from Africa, and Africa as a continent is China's second largest source of oil. So, in other words, the relationship between China and Africa is deepening, and this, of course, worries the United States, because they do not want to have to deal with the Chinese when it comes to trying to access African resources. They want to be able to have the kind of dominant power relationship that they can have over smaller African nations that have relatively less economic clout. That kind of relationship, that sort of asymmetrical power relationship, cannot exist if it's the United States dealing with or competing with China for some of the important military resources or oil resources in a variety of African countries. And you can see this concern with what the United States has with African resources going back, at the very least, and you can see where Libya factors in, you can see this concern vis-a-vis Libya, China, and African resources going back to 2002. At least the present context traces back to 2002. We know that this is a lot longer. But there was an organization or a consortium called the African Oil Policy Initiative Group. So this is a Washington group involving congressional representatives, oil industry, lobbyists, members of the military. And so going back to 2002, this group was calling for an increased American military presence in Africa and was specifically citing the need of this military presence to access some of those key African resources that I referred to moments ago, and it identified the African Oil Policy Initiative Group, that is, identified China and Libya as barriers to this goal. So some of that documentation for the AOPIG, which I was referring to, is pretty explicit about these connections between, on the one hand, the American military in having a presence in as many African countries as possible. On the other hand, Libya as a potential barrier to what a Libyan representative, I think, rightly called, quote, latter-day colonialism, end quote. And on the sort of third nexus there, the presence of China and the perception by the United States of that as a threat. So I think these are all contexts in which the NATO bombardment of Libya has to be understood, and I think it's mistaken, incredibly naive for sort of liberal humanitarians to overlook these and to sort of take NATO at its word that bringing human rights to Libya is or was really the objective of that campaign.
All right, thanks. We have to bring it to a close there, but I'm sure we could do a not dissimilar analysis of the U.S. interest in Syria, given you know, its location in the Middle East, a much more familiar neighborhood for American policymakers and anti-war activists. Okay, thanks, Greg.
That was Greg Shupak, author of a piece on the Jacobin magazine website on the sad consequences of NATO's intervention in Libya. He teaches media studies at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. I know that there's a lot of suffering going on in Syria, just as there was in Libya, but I'm afraid the U.S. and its junior military partners are not the appropriate agents to address that suffering. Also, isn't it rich that the only country ever to use nuclear weapons in war, which showered Southeast Asia with Agent Orange, left Iraq strewn with depleted uranium, and used white phosphorus in what the military calls shake-and-bake operations in Fallujah, goes on so moralistically about red lines? You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. With some of the Dona Nobis Pacem, Grant Us Peace, the conclusion of Bach's B minor Mass, performed by the Bach Collegium Stuttgart under the direction of Helmut Rilling. Next up is Monica Potts, a staff writer at the American Prospect. She's got a piece in the magazine, also on the web, on the declining life expectancy of poor, mostly rural, white women. It's a heartbreaking story in a country full of heartbreaking stories. Monica Potts. Welcome, Monica. Your piece centers on the story of a woman named Crystal Wilson, so let's just set the stage by talking a bit about her life and very early death.
Sure. Crystal Wilson was a 38-year-old woman who lived in Cave City, Arkansas, and she'd lived there her whole life. And she died at 38 for reasons that weren't immediately clear to the people who loved her. They didn't think she was sick, and they didn't know why she had passed away, and there was an autopsy done, and what really became clear was that she'd been sick for a long time and hadn't told anybody about it and probably had untreated diabetes, but she died in May 2012, about a year ago, and she, and her daughter and her family also have a lot of health problems and a lot of other problems, and Crystal hadn't graduated from high school, and she really illustrates this trend of women who don't graduate from high school and have a lot of health problems that they're unable to tackle and are related to how isolated and unhopeful their lives are.
Yeah, I mean, her employment history was about working at a chicken plant and such. It was really not something that one would envy.
Yeah, her husband had worked at a chicken plant for a while, but actually became disabled and drew SSI disability and was unable to work. And she had only worked very few jobs scattered here and there, mostly for not very much money. She babysat for friends and family, and she worked for a little while at a nursing home, you know, as a sort of an assistant there, cleaning up. And those aren't good jobs, and they're also not jobs that necessarily give you a lot of feeling like you're going somewhere in life. And that turns out to be really important. She was able to work only until she hurt her back. She wasn't in the best health in a way that nobody had noticed. She didn't have health care, so she didn't see a doctor regularly. So she really wasn't able to do the kind of physical labor, which were those were the only jobs available to her.
All right, so this is part of a larger problem, which is what your piece is about. The declining health and lifespan, which I guess is an index of just the general social well-being of white women who don't graduate from high school. I mean, this is a rather unique situation, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not really true that you see dramatic drops in life expectancy, you know, unless there's a war or some kind of influenza. And when you see a drop in life expectancy of 5 years, which is what white women without a high school degree, high school diploma are seeing, it means that a lot of women are dying very young. And they don't know exactly what's causing it, but it's probably related to the declines in job availability for those women and increased drug abuse. But drug abuse isn't the whole story, so I didn't want to concentrate on that because, first of all, there's something deeper that's driving women towards using drugs. And also because there are really sort of broader societal problems that you notice when you look at all of the research together. So, for example, women who don't have jobs are more likely to die. That was a significant factor in life expectancy for this particular group of women. And also, if you look at there's increased female mortality in about half the counties in the United States. Researchers look at county-level health often. And those counties tend to be in Appalachia and in the Ozarks and in very rural counties in the West. So there's something happening in the lives of rural women, and particularly rural white women, that is really leading to poorer lives, poorer health, and early death.
And am I remembering right that now black women are outliving white women?
That's right. In general, blacks tend to die younger than whites, but black women and men have been increasing their life expectancy at a faster rate than whites, who generally live the longest, and so or generally live longer. That's the biggest gap is between whites and blacks. And blacks are closing that gap because they're increasing their life expectancy at a faster rate. And because of what's happening with white women without college educations, black women without college educations are now outliving them. So they've actually passed whites in that one specific category.
And what's happening with men without high school educations?
White men without high school educations are also seeing their life expectancy decline by about 3 years. It's a little less dramatic, but still dramatic. And what's happening with them is also probably something similar. They don't have a lot of good economic options. Their financial lives aren't very secure. Their family lives aren't very secure anymore. So it's really happening with the poorest white people. Some of that maybe it's attributable to the fact that, you know, there aren't a ton of white people who don't go to college anymore or finish high school. So it's a smaller population, but also things have gotten much, much worse for that population. And for whatever reason, comparatively, it's not affecting the health of blacks without a high school education to the same degree.
More broadly, we are seeing a divergence in life expectancy trends by class now.
Yeah, there's a really huge difference in inequality. When you look at class inequality. So the people who live the longest are people with 16 years of education or more, and those are people with college degrees or higher. And they live much, much longer, and no one's ever really known exactly why that is, whether it's education itself or being able to attain a level of education like that indicates something about how good your life is. But the gap isn't closing, it's widening, and I think that's what's really shocking for researchers and really disturbing for them.
And what sort of explanations are researchers developing for the reasons that poor women are suffering such a fate?
They're still doing research on that. It's sort of hard to isolate causes for something like that, but I spoke to Jane Jackson, who's a researcher at the University of Michigan in behavioral health. And he is looking on sort of health patterns of poor white women, and he feels that they're taking on more destructive behaviors than poor black women do and uneducated black women do. So it's possible that they just live in communities where it's more socially acceptable to, you know, drink Dr. Pepper all day and also do drugs and also smoke. The smoking rates and the drug use rates for uneducated black women aren't as high as they are for uneducated white women, he believes. So he thinks that that's a really big contributing factor. But otherwise, it might have something to do with where they live, and it might have something to do with the kinds of communities they live in, and just the opportunities that are available to them, and the relative power they have over men in their communities who tend to do better, because we still live in a society that favors men.
I'm speaking with Monica Potts, who is a staff writer at The American Prospect.
Yeah, I was wondering if does the social isolation of rural life have anything to do with it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that especially for women who don't have a job, that the chances that you just have a lot of other friends who you're able to connect with regularly in a social setting is just, it's just lessened. There aren't community centers. There aren't neighborhood hangouts. There aren't houses that are near each other. They're out in the middle of nowhere. And so that, I think, really sort of isolates those women. And loneliness is a really big factor in health. One of the things that you see over the course of Crystal Wilson's life is that she's really lonely.
And, yeah, you touched on this, but also not having a job seems to be damaging. Why? Why is that? It's not just the money aspect, right?
It's not just the money, because researchers who did one study to look at that, the factors that contributed to the cause of death, and they found joblessness to be one. Other indicators of income didn't matter as much, like whether they owned a house or whether their spouse had a job. And so they theorized that going to a job connected you with social networks of other women and other men, and also connected you to networks of people who had some amount of power in society, so you weren't so, you know, you weren't so isolated, and you were able to connect with other people on a regular basis. It gives you something to do and something to look for, really.
This really hasn't attracted all that much attention from the broad public, or even the policy public, has it?
It has some, although I think the health policy researchers are still very cautious because they're still doing research on this. All of these studies have been written about by Sabrina Tavernisi in the New York Times. Not all of them, but most of them. And so there's some amount of attention to it, but it's a hard thing to wrap your mind around. It's not 100% clear what's happening. It seems easy to say that people should just stay in school because that's so highly correlated with longer lifespans. But the things that cause people to drop out of high school and not go to college, or even to drop out of college, are really dramatic and terrible. Even just 1 year of college improves your lifespan, but getting the people there who are least likely to go would take a huge intervention. It's that people who drop out of high school are having a really hard time, and there's a lot that factors into that.
And, of course, we can't tell whether it's the education itself or the motivation to become educated that makes the difference.
That's right, or also your family situation. If you have a family that can get you to college and get you through high school, then you already have a lot of other things that are better off for you. But one of the things that researchers have noticed is that 1 year of college is the biggest gap. Just getting through people through 1 year of college seems to improve their chances a lot, and they think it has to do with getting out of the environment that they were in, that the people most likely to leave high school are just in an environment that is toxic in some way or another.
Even if you go to college, if you live miles even from the nearest Walmart, you don't have a whole lot of opportunities in life.
That's right. I think people don't understand how hard it is for people who live in poor communities to find work. There aren't good-paying jobs around the corner. There aren't businesses investing in the neighborhoods. There aren't places to, you know, even put in an application. You have to do a lot of traveling and a lot of work just to get a job, and it's really overwhelming to try to think about doing that on a day-to-day basis.
And just to underscore the emergency or the unusualness of this sort of decline in lifespan in a country not at war, not experiencing some kind of plague, is extraordinarily unusual. Well, the only modern precedent really is what happened after the fall of the Soviet Union, isn't it?
That's right. Soviet men lost 7 years after the fall. And that was, when you think about it, the collapse of an entire country and way of life. And so that was really dramatic, but there was a dramatic, you know, thing that happened right before it. The men were used to living a certain way in society, and that suddenly ended. And they think that what caused that dramatic drop of 7 years was an increase in drinking and all of the kinds of deaths that drinking can cause, like car accidents and other problems. And so that was a situation that you could point to what was causing it, and there really isn't much of that here except the dramatic rise in income inequality in America and the Great Recession, which has just devastated the poorest communities.
Regardless of the cause, it is a sign of a true social emergency.
It really is, and it's something to think about because as we go forward, we haven't really had a discussion following the Great Recession about how to reset the social contract for the poorest Americans. We've had a lot of discussions about the decline of the middle class, which is important because that's where poor people move into, is hopefully they move into the middle class. But there aren't ladders into the middle class anymore. There aren't jobs that people can get that turn into a manager job that makes more money. And college is very expensive. If college is so important for people to attend, then there also should be a discussion about how it is that we can get people into college who are the least likely to go and help them pay for it.
But then, of course, if you're living in a place where you can't really get a good job, then going to college will leave you high and dry.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's another aspect of it, is that it'll leave these communities even more destitute, because that's part of what's been happening now. And the people who are stuck in those communities may even be worse off. So it's really a huge thing.
I mean, certainly, since we don't really fully know the causes of this, it's a little premature to ask the question, but are there any kinds of policy interventions that might turn the situation around?
You know, I asked everyone the question of what they think could be done and what they thought was causing it, and it seems sort of hard to kind of guess that, because people have known for a long time that education is really important, and people have worked on raising graduation rates in all kinds of neighborhoods across the country. And we've worked on creating a path to college for everyone. We've worked on universal health care. Hopefully that we'll start to see some of the benefits of what we have of that so far come into effect soon. There are a lot of rural health clinics. There are a lot of people who do have access. There are a lot of ways to access the medical system if you are a poor person in any kind of community. But it hasn't really associated with, it hasn't overcome the gap in health, life expectancy that is related to education.
Is this mostly a rural phenomenon, or do we see something similar in cities?
It's mostly rural. This particular phenomenon is mostly affecting poor white women, and those women tend to be found in rural areas.
That was Monica Potts, the staff writer for the American Prospect, talking about her piece in the magazine, and also on the web, about the declining life expectancy of poor, mostly rural, white women. Finally, some excerpts from a talk given by the literary critic and theorist Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak at the Gramsci Monument in the Bronx on August 24th. Spivak, one of the most prominent names associated with the School of Deconstruction, teaches at Columbia University. The monument, a grandiose name for a structure built out of 2x4s and plywood, to the Italian political philosopher Antonio Gramsci, was conceived by the Swiss artist Thomas Hirschhorn as a temporary installation and erected on the grounds of the Forest Houses, a public housing project in the only one of the five boroughs of New York City that's on the American mainland. The idea is profoundly moving, and Spivak was visibly moved by it, bringing the ideas and personality of an Italian Marxist imprisoned by Mussolini to a part of the world where revolutionary politics and art can be in short supply. Spivak's talk was part of a series of events at the monument. Anyone who's read her work or heard her speak will know that immediate comprehensibility is not one of her more prominent features, but that was not true of this talk. I apologize for the poor sound quality. I recorded it spontaneously outdoors amidst a lot of background noise using the voice memos feature on my iPhone. I should have brought my fancy Olympus recorder, but I didn't think of it beforehand. I'll introduce each section. Spivak's first point is about the importance of popular education, a nice counterpoint to the idea that more poor women need to go to college for vocational reasons. Gramsci's idea was much broader.
When he was organizing the Fiat automobile factory workers in 1920 and before, he was interested in having educational units outside of the job-related work of the unions. Why? Because with the business opportunities offered by the other side, it is the rules of business, not the freedom of the community to think and act for the welfare of all, that is emphasized. I'm putting it in today's language, but if you read Gramsci's remarks about what the management is offering and how they're winning over the workers, I put it in today's language. But that's why Gramsci had the workers' councils. Not everybody liked it. Certainly not the union leaders. They did not like it. The union is enough. But he said that no, that was not enough. And this is before he went to jail. Okay.
Next, Spivak talks about ethnicity and gender in politics, riffing off a pamphlet from the New York City Housing Authority addressed to minority and women-owned businesses looking to transact with the authority. Spivak addresses the limitations of that approach, which he ties to classic American electoral appeals to demographics. I love the bit about how, as a feminist, she finds the notion of woman extremely alarming.
When you're invited to register your firm with the New York City Housing Authority Supply Management Department and become a part of our MWSBE directory by completing the MWSBE registration form, you need no other qualification but percentage ownership by ethnicity and gender. If I know my Gramsci, Gramsci would interfere right here. But anyway, so from that point of view, and then it comes the minority-owned, women-owned, Asian-Pacific, Black, Pacific Jews, Hispanic, Native American, women, etc. Women. As a feminist, I find this category, women, to be extremely alarming. But that's as it may be. Okay. Those who oppose us by race or gender, to keep us poor, make us undemocratic. Those who oppose us by race or gender to keep us poor make us undemocratic, because democracy has no ethnicity and no gender. Go and look at Du Bois's writings and you will see how when the as he says, Negroes, right after the emancipation, were obliged to form a different labor movement, he said this is a blow against democracy. So this, we've forgotten this. We've now got our idea of democracy is voting blocks. But in fact, those who oppose us by race or gender make us undemocratic, because democracy has no ethnicity and no gender. It is one person, one vote, based not on ethnic solidarity, but judgment. The secret is an education that does not only lead to jobs. When Gramsci said, everyone is an intellectual, and this is quoted ad absurdum, this is constantly quoted, just this little bit. When Gramsci said everyone is an intellectual, he did not mean let's burn the schools. That remark, everyone is an intellectual, and I'll come back to it at the end, is empty when mounted by over-educated people like myself. It is not a question of subject matter alone either, nor of gathering information. It is a question of making minds that will read the information right. That's much harder.
Here Spivak talks about how political action directed at the poor, very common among non-profit types and even a lot of radicals, is just not enough.
The access to such education is not easy for the poor or for minorities. Tests have nothing to do with it. And on the other hand, if one only works to end the misery of the poor, the minority, the racialized, the gender oppressed, however big the group of protesters may be, without such education, looking toward everyone, nothing will last. Nothing will last if a collectivity looks only at itself. This is the truth. Remember the occupiers, the Arab Spring. Gramsci's word here was, and I quote, political passion, even if fiery, incandescent in Italian, political passion, even if fiery, cannot lead to permanent political structures, End of quote. That's Gramsci.
And finally, a marvelous dismissal of the privilege discourse so popular among some sections of the left. The work she refers to at the beginning of this section is her education work among the very poor in India.
So before I started working, I had, this work. I would say, unlearn your privilege. I think that's a remarkably stupid thing to say. And, because it's very narcissistic, you just keep thinking, oh, my privilege, I'll unlearn. You cannot unlearn your privilege. It's a historical thing. History is larger than personal goodwill. But after I started working, I realized that I should use my bloody privilege, because it gives me, first of all, it makes my work suspicious from the do-gooders, from the point of view of the do-gooders. Oh, well, she's behaving like a run in upper class. Of course I am. I have certain kinds of power. I'm a Columbia professor. I have certain kinds of power. I'm using it for the sake of people who want to kiss my backside but won't do a damn thing for the people for whom I teach, whose teacher I am.
Those are some excerpts from a talk given by the literary theorist Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak, professor at Columbia University, at the Gramsci Monument, a temporary installation at a public housing compound in the Bronx on August 24th. Apologies again for the sound quality. I was far from the stage, and there were crowd noises and even crickets. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the LCD Sound System's All My Friends, covered by John Cale. Till next week, bye.